Maybe you had a teddy bear or a doll. It's so far in my past, I can't even remember if I had one now. But I remember our kids, and I know my grandchildren. And it could be a rag doll, it could be a bunny, it could be a soft toy of some description or a teddy bear, but it becomes the most loved thing in the house. And after a while, it looks pretty scruffy. True? I don't know if you guys are awake this morning, but I have in my image my granddaughter's lion, which she got when she was born as a gift. And Granny has had to fix that about 7 or 8 times. I doubt if there's anything of the original one left. Because when an arm falls off, another one gets crocheted and knitted on. And then the other one falls off. But heaven help us if that thing gets lost. Because it is loved. But anyone looking at it, anyone seeing it would think, man, you should have thrown that out long ago. So I want to read to you from Luke 7. If you want to follow, it's from verse 36. And I'm going to read in the New International. Luke 7, 36 to the end. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, so she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she's a sinner." Jesus answered him, even though he hadn't spoken, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now which one of them will love him more?" Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven." "You've judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned towards the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little." Then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." And the other guests began to say among themselves, Who is this who even forgives sins?" And Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Some of you might have come across Tony Campola. He's a sociologist, he's a Christian, he writes some really provocative and wonderful stuff. But in a book that he wrote, The Kingdom of God is a Party, he has this story. And it takes place in Hawaii. He's traveled to Hawaii, he's traveled a distance to get there, and as it says in the story, he was still on Eastern Standard Time, so he'd flown right across America to Hawaii, and he was unable to sleep. And he wandered into an all-night diner, as he puts it, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the only other customers were a bunch of prostitutes who had finished for the night. One of them was named Agnes, mentioned that tomorrow was her birthday, and just in passing, basically, that she had never had a birthday party in her life. And after these women left, Tony went to the owner of the diner, his name was Harry, and said to him, "Do you mind if I throw a party for Agnes tomorrow night?" And he said, "Fine, on one condition, that I'll cook the food and my wife will make the cake." This is his rendition of the story. I'll read it to you now. "At 2:30 the next morning, I was back at the diner. I had picked up some crepe paper decorations at the store and had made a sign out of a big piece of cardboard that read, 'Happy Birthday, Agnes.' The woman who did the cooking must have gotten word out on the street, because by 3:15, every prostitute in Honolulu was in the place. It was wall-to-wall prostitutes and me. At 3:30, the door of the diner swung open and in came Agnes and her friend. I had everybody ready, and when they came in, we all screamed, 'Happy birthday!' Never have I seen a person so flabbergasted. Her mouth fell open and her legs buckled. When we finished singing, her eyes moistened. When the cake was carried out, she started to cry. Harry gruffly mumbled, 'Blow out the candles, Agnes, come on. If you don't blow out the candles, I'm going to have to blow out the candles.' Finally, he did. The cutting of the cake took even longer. 'Cut the cake, Agnes. We all want some cake.' 'Look, Harry, if it's okay, I'd like to keep the cake for a little while. Maybe we don't eat it straight away. Can I?' 'Sure, if you want to keep it, keep it. Take it to your home if you want.' Then, looking at me, she said, 'I live just down the street. I want to take the cake home. Okay, I'll be right back.' She carried that cake out of the door like it was the Holy Grail. We stood there motionless, a stunned silence in the place, not knowing what else to do. I broke the silence by saying, 'What do you say we pray?' Looking back on it now, it seems more than strange for a sociologist to be leading a prayer meeting with a bunch of prostitutes in a diner in Honolulu at 3:30 in the morning. But then it just felt like the right thing to do. I prayed for Agnes, for her salvation, for her life to be changed, that God would be good to her. When I finished, Harry leaned over the counter and said with a trace of irritation, 'Hey, you never told me you were a preacher. What kind of church do you belong to?' In one of those moments when just the right words come, I answered, 'I belong to a church that throws birthday parties for prostitutes at 3:30 in the morning.' Harry waited a moment and almost sneered as he answered, 'No, you don't. There's no such church like that. If there was, I'd join it.' I remember when I first read that story, how moving and challenged I was. Because we are built in our society to love the things that are beautiful. But the broken things, the rag dolls, the things that seem to be worthless, we've got very little time for. There are two things, I think, that matter deeply. And after we've had this whole thing of revelation for the last couple of months, I thought this morning it's good to remind ourselves of these two things. And the first is this. We are all rag dolls. We are all Agneses. One of the most profound movements in America in the last century or so has been the AA movement. And it is profound in the sense that what happens is that people come to the place where they have become almost unable to carry on because of their addiction. Either alcohol, there's various different kinds now in terms of drug addiction and so on. One of the prerequisites is that they come in and they be able to say, "Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an addict," of whatever you add on to it. It's only then that they can begin the process of coming to terms with where they are, what has happened to them, and how they can move forward. We are all, every single one of us, flawed, broken, bruised, damaged, whatever language you want, sinner. Since the fall. And part of our raggedness is what happens to us. There is stuff that happens that we have no control over. And it impacts the way that we see ourselves and see the world and live our lives. But part of our raggedness is some of the deposits that we make ourselves. We can't throw stones at someone else without injuring ourselves. Someone said, it's like, and I actually thought if I was doing the kids thing today, I'd do it, but you've grown up, you can imagine this. A glass of water and a tiniest, tiniest drop of ink. I still use fountain pens, by the way. I've got about 5 of them on my desk. When it comes to cleaning them, it's a mess because the tiniest, teeniest spot of ink in water just goes like this. We're infected with the same brokenness and raggedness. It permeates our life. We're never, ever entirely free of it until everything is sorted out. But the other great truth is this, is that we are God's ragdolls. Yes, that smelly old bit of bear or doll or whatever it happens to be ought to have been thrown out long ago. But we hold on to it and it's kept for forever, not because it's beautiful, not because it's great, not because it has any value in any sense, but because it's loved. And we are God's ragdolls. We are loved. I think one of the most, and this is just a personal thing, I think one of the most profound things that ever happened in my life was coming across a passage in Deuteronomy where God says to them, "You are the head and not the tail." And I suddenly realized, I am the head, I'm not the tail. I am loved. I am valuable. I am important. I am part of God's equation. And I suddenly realized that no matter whatever happens in my whole life, that is an unshakable, immutable fact. Now, I'm not here to confess this morning and to give you a whole list of my own personal brokenness, because most of you can probably recognize it anyway. But the truth is that what you cannot take from me ever is the fact that I am loved. I am loved by God no matter where I've been and no matter what I've done, no matter what my history, no matter what my present, I'm loved. And I think one of the most important things for us to realize is that our brokenness is not the most important thing about us. Yes, we are sinners, but that's not the most important thing about us. The fact that we are loved is the most important thing about us. Right at the beginning, when God created everything, he created mankind. And what did he say when he saw it? Nope, he didn't say it's good. He said it's very good. Everything else was, this is good, but this is very good. I'm pleased with this. And I know that when God looks at me, he looks at me because I am created in his image, and he says, that's very good. It's not quite complete yet, and Gail will tell you that's true. It's not quite complete yet, but when God looks at me, he sees who I am in him. I'm loved. I am loved, and nothing in heaven or earth can change that. I think what happens is that we believe all the other voices, and there are hundreds of them in our society, in our families. We believe all the other voices that tell you, you're stupid. When I was growing up, it was, you're thick. Thick as a plank. You'll never amount to anything. And all these things that we are told, not often verbally, but in subtle and sometimes less subtle ways, those are not the important voices. The important voice is this, that God says to us, you are loved. No matter what, you are loved. Brokenness, raggedness is not your identity. And it's not your destiny. It's not your future. There is healing through the cross. We may be unlovely, but we are not unloved. Does that make sense? We may be unlovely, but we're not unloved. You know the whole thing of Eros? And agape. Okay. I want to just stop for a second. I must keep an eye on the time, otherwise I'll get shot afterwards. We used to the type of love where people look for something that is worthwhile loving. So, oh, I love that car. No one ever says that about my car. I love my car. It's safe, it doesn't give any trouble, and it gets me from A to B. But you hear what I'm saying? We look at certain things and we say our value system in our culture is to say those things are loved, but those things we can do without. And we celebrate beauty and strength and skill. We live in a society that has such a heavy emphasis. Look at some of the stuff that comes out on the news with people remodeling their faces so that they are selfie ready all the time. It is frightening. Because we think that we can only be loved if we have certain things, do certain things, and look like certain things. That's the word the Greeks used eros for. And we think of eros as erotic love. And it is. It's used as a word for sexual love. But the word at its core describes the kind of love I give to anything that satisfies my desire. I love something. And the eros love is the love that satisfies me in some way. I am satisfied. And there was a whole lot of, just about every fairy tale, if you think of it, Cinderella. Cinderella is not loved because she's intelligent and has sensitive conversation. Is she? No. And if you think of Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, they get the prince when they're comatose. Seriously. Eros is a love that comes from need, admiration, desire. And it's not necessarily bad. It's good that the baby loves the mother who gives her milk. It's great that the lover celebrates the beauty of his love. But eros is fragile. And if that's the only love that we understand this love to be, if you build your life on that kind of love, then you will be vulnerable. You will be terribly vulnerable. Because I can tell you now, you will never be pretty enough. And I'm talking to the men. I'm not. You will never be pretty enough. You will never make the grade. You will never be bright enough. You will never be rich enough. And you can keep going on with the list, because there is, like Rockefeller said, how much do you want? He said, just a little bit more. Because this kind of love, where it's only to fulfill our desires, our needs, is a bottomless pit. And it's like a vortex, a black hole that sucks in but never satisfies. If it's cut loose of the other kind of love. Even spirituality. In the church, people want to look spiritual. They want to look okay and good. You will never be spiritual enough. So relax. As usual, I've run ahead of myself. Let's just go here. Love is why God created us in the first place. Full stop. But I was going to read to you here from Romans. Romans 5. And if you want to read it, it's verse 6, 7, and 8. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still ragdolls, while we were still broken, while whatever you want to add into it, addicted, Christ died for us. He loved us in spite of who we were. And he's fully aware of who we are. He knows exactly what we like. It's not that there's anything hidden. It's logical to throw away the human race and start afresh. But he says, that's not what I planned in the beginning. He created us and he says, look, this is really good. He loves us unreservedly. Scripture writers didn't want to use eros to describe this love of God. So what they did was something quite interesting, because when you go back into ancient Greek, the word agape that we bandy about so freely and comfortably was very seldom used in Hellenistic and classical Greek. It was just a very bland word for love. It was the New Testament writers who filled it and gave it new meaning in terms of linking it in with the kind of love that they saw in Jesus and in God. And I want to remind you this morning that we want over this church in the future, now even, I want over my life. I don't care that I didn't become prime minister or president. I don't care. What I long for is that I am known as somebody who loves. That we are a congregation of people, a people who are known for the love that they have, that isn't this needy love of having my needs met. I love you because of what you can give to me. It's self-sacrificial. There are two commandments that we have, and we will beat on about this ad nauseum over the years. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. And go into all the world and make disciples. And really, Thy Kingdom Come that we saw the clip from earlier on today is an expression of that. We come from a place where we are apprehended and we understand that we are loved. And we cannot but help going to see and to say to other people, there is love, there is hope in the life that you have that is broken. You may feel like a rag doll, a broken bunny, a thrown away teddy bear. But there is real, real hope. Here's the thing. If we're serious about loving God, where do we begin? We had a bit of a chat about this in our small group on Wednesday night. Where do we begin if we're serious about loving God? We start with the people who are in front of us. And we start especially with the people that the world discards. Luke 7, which we read earlier on, takes place in Nain, which is in the hill country just to the southwest of Lake Galilee. And Jesus is eating with Simon. Simon is probably not a bad fellow. He's invited Jesus to come. He's probably, there's a whole list of things that happened prior to this. He's probably intrigued. He probably wants to work out what's exactly going on here. And he invites Jesus for dinner. Then this woman enters, and the sort of euphemistic sinner word is, bluntly, she was a prostitute. She was a hooker. Polite way of saying it, and she's uninvited. That can really create waves in your party. And it scandalized people in the room except for one, because she'd lost her reputation and she'd lost pretty much all her virtue. But the interesting thing is that I was just thinking about this yesterday. A rag doll that's all chewed up and messed up or whatever didn't used to look like that. This woman has got to this place, and who knows why, but she was somebody's little girl at some stage. She was someone who had some aspirations and hopes for her future. And here she is. And I think one of the wisest things I've ever heard is the North American Indians say that you never judge a man until you've walked 2 weeks in his moccasins. You do not know what those people are struggling with, their history, their environment, and so on. But here she is. She's had the stuffing knocked out of her. And it's probably years since she was in public with anyone reputable. But she's come, and as she comes, and I was just trying to imagine the scene and thinking, you know, reclining at table, the food would be central. They would be sort of semi, what's the word I want? Lying down. Reclining. It's the same word. But they would be reclining and they would have their heads towards the table and their feet out. And so she comes up behind Jesus. And whether she's overcome with what she's heard, we don't know why. But there is this deep and profound sense for her where all she can do is begin to weep. And as she's standing there, her tears begin to splatter on Jesus' feet. And then she takes her hair, which it was a scandal to let your hair down in public. She'd probably let her hair down in many ways more than once. But she lets her hair down in this public space, in the Pharisee's home. And she begins to wipe Jesus' feet and she begins to anoint it with the perfume that she bought. And suddenly, not only is there quiet weeping and the scene that's going on, but suddenly the room is filled with this intense fragrance. Because it's not like a drop here, you know, little here. It's like she anoints his feet. And you can almost hear the stress rising in Simon's brain. And Jesus says to him, "Simon, I want to say something to you." "Yes, Lord." And then he says this little parable about someone who owes what would just roughly would be a year and a half salary, and someone who owes like a month and a half salary. And neither of them can ever hope to pay it back. And they are forgiven. And he answers correctly. And I think we must be careful, because it's very easy for us to, we sit in judgment, because surely at this point, Lord, it would have been a great thing to give a little moral tale here. But scandalously, all Jesus is concerned about at this point is forgiveness and love. And you know how the story goes, we read it, but essentially what Jesus is saying, "Simon, you could not really understand this kind of love, because you haven't really understood forgiveness. You don't understand what a mess you are. You don't understand how far from grace you are." And I need to say to you this morning, we are all ragdolls. We are all broken and wounded. And we need to be kind and gentle and patient with one another. But not just here. We need to be gracious to people that we meet, because each one of them is like this woman. Each one of them, Jesus is just looking to see what's going on here. In essence, what Jesus is saying, she may be a rag doll, but she's my rag. And everybody that we see is his. And I am his. And let me tell you, over the years, people have said some nasty things to me and to Gail. People get nasty. It's one of the things. I have an image in my head that helps me. You know, the little boy who is bullied, and then his dad happens to be this huge, huge, huge Hulk kind of guy. That's the image I have. You do not know who you are dealing with. You say something bad about me or to me, or you try and hurt me, and fair enough, I don't need to retaliate, because my dad's looking out for me. My dad loves me. I'm loved. Your bad opinion of me is not going to define who I am, because I am defined not by my brokenness any longer. I am defined by the fact that my dad loves me more than I can even ask or imagine. Go and read Romans. Nothing, nothing, nothing in heaven and earth, nothing at all can ever separate you from God's love. What have we got to worry about? But it goes the other way as well, because every single person that you encounter, love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, because they're loved by him just as I am loved by him. And that's important to understand. They might not yet realize it. That's part of what we want to do, praying for people, telling them about this whole thing of who Jesus is. It's a package deal, guys. I think God's saying, love me, love my ragdolls.